Sure is good to see everybody who's here this morning. We're so thankful for your presence, and I appreciate the way that we have conducted our service thus far. Appreciate the good attention that Alan gave to the Lord's Supper, helping us to realize that our Lord fulfilled every scripture concerning himself, and what a wonderful thing it is to know that he is indeed the perfect sacrifice. Good to see everybody who is here this morning. Let me mention also this coming Wednesday night, I'd like for us to begin our kids class again. I decided to hold that until the first of the year. We're going to do that about 6:40, like 20 minutes till the hour. And so those of you who can, come Wednesday night with your kids, and we'll do our little kids class up here before they go to their regular classes. Again, that'll be at 6:40 on Wednesday night. Well, as all of us know and has already been said, 2024 is on the horizon. Here we are at the last day of 2023, and if God be willing, we're going to enter into the new year. A lot of times people will come to this time of year and make resolutions, and I understand that. It's a good break. You finished one year, you're going into another year. I don't always do that because most of my major resolutions are already fixed. But there is a need sometimes to begin to think about things that you would like to change, things you would like to do better that do that. One of the neater ideas that has come along in recent years is that people will choose a single word, a word that is going to sum up everything that they would like to change in that particular area. And so this year I decided to do that for myself. I chose one word that is going to be my word throughout 2024. And this might not be your resolution, but I would like to suggest that it is something that all of us need to be concerned about and all of us need to give attention to. My word for 2024 is simply present. And I readily admit to you that this is one of my greatest weaknesses. And so because of that, I really, really, really want to work on it. And what I mean when I talk about the word present, I'm talking about being in the present moment. Because a lot of times I'm not. I'm not in the present moment. My mind is somewhere else, and that's not good. And I want to suggest to you that I actually believe that, for me at least, I believe that's sinful. That here's an important moment that all of me needs to be in. But I'm not really there. In James chapter 4 and verse 17, this is a broad sweep right here, but in verse 17, it says, "Therefore, let him who knows to do good to do it. Because to the one who knows to do good, and him, it is sin." And so I'm talking about something that, at least in my thinking, I believe that it's sinful for me not to be in the present moment, especially when I am with people. And when I am with people, it is absolutely crucial that I be there in that moment. Another definition that we might could give of this that might make it even easier to remember is to simply be where your feet are. Because sometimes what happens is our feet are here, but my head and my heart is somewhere else. Even right now, I would venture to say that on any given Sunday, that probably happens, that somebody is here, but they're not here. Their feet is here, they're in their place in the pew, but their head and their heart has not entered into it. They're able to sing and mouth words, but the head and the heart's not in it. They're able to sit through a prayer, but their head and their heart is not in it. And they can sit through a sermon and maybe not be engaged at all. And Jesus talked about how that could happen. In Matthew, the 15th chapter and verse 8. Matthew, the 15th chapter and verse 8. Now, Jesus is talking about hypocrisy here, but I do believe the principle still applies. In Matthew 15 and verse 8, Jesus said, "These people draw near to me with their mouth, and they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me." Now, Jesus is talking about a deeper situation that here's people who go through the motions, they say the right things, they maybe offer their with me. They don't care about living for me day in and day out. They're just putting on a show. And that's why he says in verse 7, he refers to them as hypocrites. But it still doesn't change the fact that even if we're not hypocrites, it's still very easy for us to not be where our feet are. it's very easy for us not to be in the present moment. And I want to suggest to you that this is a challenge to all of us in a major way, because every single day we are bombarded with what I will call digital distractions. Watch people when they are together. Watch some of your family gatherings. I venture to say that it probably happened at some of your family gatherings, where here's people that maybe you haven't been around in a while, but yet instead of talking and engaging and connecting and listening, everybody's doing this. And so it's very easy for us to not be in the present moment, that we're with people, but we're not with people. I'm with you, but I'm not with you. My head and my heart are somewhere else. I'm guilty of that. But I tell you what I'm even more so guilty of, is that sometimes I'm not listening. I'm thinking about something else. My mind is somewhere else, and I'm really not hearing what you're saying, because my head and my heart are not where my feet are. And I believe that is a serious, serious thing. And I would like to suggest to you that Jesus never made that mistake. Jesus never made that mistake. Jesus always was where his feet were. He was always. And I tell you what that brings. When you do that, you're going to find greater happiness. When you're really, really connecting with people, you're going to have greater fulfillment in your life, and you're going to have success. And when I talk about success, I'm not talking about for your glory or for your benefit, but you're going to have success with people for Christ. You're going to have an impact on them, and your life is going to be a life of significance, because you truly are connecting with people. That's what Jesus did everywhere he went. The simplest way to say it is that if you want to win the moment, you've got to be in the moment. Now let me ask you this question. Do you know of anybody who connected better with people than Jesus did? There has never been anybody who had a greater impact on people than Jesus did. And that's because people felt valued by him. Look at John the 12th chapter now. In John the 12th chapter in verse 9. John the 12th chapter. And actually we're looking at verse 19. This is after Jesus had raised Lazarus from the dead. And people were already coming to him in droves. But when you look at verse 19, it says, the Pharisees therefore said among themselves, "You see that you are accomplishing nothing. Look, the whole world has gone after him." That's a statement. The whole world is going after him. He is making a connection with the people that he is with. In fact, they called him the friend of sinners. They meant for that to be a slap to Jesus, but it was one of the greatest compliments ever. That he is a friend of sinners. Sinners are drawn to him. Sinners want to talk to him. Sinners who want to change are coming to him. The whole world's going after him. And 12 men, I'm going to say 11 plus 1, 11 of the original apostles, and then the apostle Paul himself gave their lives for him. They bonded with Jesus, because he always made it a point to be present for them. Look at Mark, the 3rd chapter. In Mark chapter 3, beginning in verse 13, this is when Jesus is going to choose the 12 apostles. It says that he went up on the mountain and he called to them those who he himself wanted, and they came to him. And then he appointed 12, but notice this next phrase. Then he appointed 12 that they might be with him. I think that says a whole lot. He appointed these 12 that they might be with him, and that he might send them out to preach and to have the power to heal sicknesses and to cast out demons. One of the reasons these men became a major force in the world is because Jesus was present with them. Jesus was giving them what they needed. And among that was simply his presence that valued them. And so what I'm simply saying for myself in 2024 is I want to do that. I want to care for people like that. I want to care for people in such a way that they are drawn to Jesus. And you know that ought to be our aim always. Look at Matthew the 5th chapter in verse 13. in Matthew the 5th chapter and verse 13. In the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus said it this way. He said, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men." You are the salt of the earth. He's saying you have an impact. You have an influence. And if you're not doing that, then he says you're no better than what they throw out on the streets for people to walk on. If the salt loses its flavor, it's no different than gravel. And so he says, be an influence. Verse 14, "You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house." So you are the salt of the earth. You are a light in this world. And then verse 16, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works, and they may glorify your Father who is in heaven." And so the greatest way for you and I to strengthen our connections with people is by being in the present moment, by being where our feet are. Because I want to tell you that I believe that my time and your attention is the greatest gift that you can give to them. And the reason being is our most precious resource. I don't know if you've ever thought about it, but that's exactly true. Time is our most precious resource. I want you to think with me about James chapter 4. Turn to James chapter 4 and look with me in verse 13. In James chapter 4, beginning in verse 13, James talks about life. Here's people who think they had the whole thing lined out. They knew exactly how things were going to go. James 4 and verse 13, he says, "Come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we will go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit. Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow." And then here's the key thing I'm looking at. He says, "What is your life? It is even as a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away." Here you are thinking you're going to go to this city, spend this much time here, and you even know you're going to make a profit. You've got it all lined up. But do you not know that you could die tonight? Do you not understand that your life is as a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away? And he goes on to say, as you're looking at the text, he says, "Instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. But now you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is vain. Therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin." I want to impress a few things upon you from James chapter 4. When you were born, the hourglass got flipped. And your life and the time that God has for your life began to move. So you're born and the hourglass gets flipped. And there are three indisputable truths about time that all of us need to understand. First of all, none of us have any idea of how much sand is at the top. Do you know how much life you've got left? Do you know how much sand is at the top? You don't know, and I don't know. And what that means is that every moment counts, because I don't know how much is at the top. That means that every single moment of my life matters, and every single moment of your life matters. Look at Psalm 139 and verse 16. In Psalm 139 and verse 16, the context here is talking about God forming you in the womb, talking about your being formed there and your eventual birth. Verse 15, he says, "My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the lowest parts of the earth. Your eyes saw my substance being yet unformed, and in your book they all were written, the days fashioned for me, when as yet there were none of them." There are a number of people, and I probably am closer to one of them, that believe that God has our days numbered. That before we've ever lived them, those days are written in His book. Now, I can affect that by my decisions. I can affect that by deciding that I'm not going to do this or that. That might put me in danger and that might extend it. But it seems to me the verse may very well be saying that the days that are fashioned for me are already written in God's book before there were none of them. How much sand is at the top for me? How much sand is at the top for you? In Psalm 90 and verse 10, we're told that that ought to give us a heart of wisdom. In Psalm 90 and verse 10, it says, "The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, and it is soon cut off, and we fly away." Now that's talking about the general average. And you know, from what I understand from looking at things, even with all the advancements that we have, this is still pretty much on the mark. The days of our lives are 70 years. That's the average time span. If you have a little extra strength than another, you might see 80. But what's going to eventually happen is you're going to soon be cut off and fly away. That's where we get the song, "Some glad morning when this life is over, I'll fly away." And so because my days are numbered, what should I do? Verse 12. He says, "So teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom." So nobody has an idea how much sand is at the top, and every moment counts. Here's a second indispensable truth. You cannot stop the sand from falling to the bottom. Some of it's already dropped in the last 10 or 15 minutes, and you couldn't stop it. Your lives are passing on. And here's another thing that's crucial, is you can't pause it. You can't say, "Well, I just want to stop time for a second." No, you can't pause it. And then the third thing is this. Once the sand hits the bottom, it's gone. That gets my attention. Once the sand hits the bottom, it's gone. And you cannot get it back. The past is the past. You can't relive it. You can't go back and do it over. Once the sand hits the bottom, it's over. Now, we can learn from it. We can learn from the past. We can learn from what's already hit the bottom, but you can't get it back. In 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 15, we see that that was evidently the thinking of the Apostle Paul as he talked about his past life. He talks about how that he was a blasphemer, a persecutor, an insolent man, all of these things that he had done that he was so ashamed of, persecuting Christians. But then he finally says in 1 Timothy 1 and verse 15 concerning his life, "This is a faithful saying and worthy of all acceptance, that Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners, of whom I am chief." As he looked at his life, he says, that's me, that's what I've been. But what he's recognized is, I can't change that. I can't get it back. It was what it was. I did what I did. But I can take that and I can learn from it. And now that God has saved me through the grace of Jesus Christ, I can make a major impact in this world, and that's what I intend to do. And that's what the Apostle Paul said he intended to do, is make a big impact. And boy, if there ever was one who did that, he certainly did. So because time is our most precious resource, the greatest gift that you can give anybody is your time and your attention. Because here's the truth of the matter. You are communicating something to somebody every time you're with them. Anytime you're with somebody, you are communicating something, and it's not always with your mouth. But what we need to be communicating by being present with people is this: you are important to me. Do you think it tells the person when you're with them and you're over here, and they're trying to talk to you, and you're over here, and you didn't hear really anything they said, or maybe you stop for a moment and say, "Yeah, that's right," and then you go, does that tell them you're important to me? No, because if you were important, I'd put the thing down and I'd listen to you. You are important to me. Secondly, I care about you. It's obvious by the way I'm listening that I care about you. And then this, what you have to say is something that I value. And when you think about Jesus, that's exactly the way he came across to people. You're important to me. I care about you. I care about your life. And anything you have to say is something that I value. There is no greater glue in the world to bond people than that. If you've ever wondered why those 12 men would be willing to die for him, it's because he had been present with them. He had invested in them. He cared about every single one of them, and each one of them knew it. And so as a result, we have a passage like 1 John chapter 4 and verse 19. 1 John chapter 4 and verse 19 says, we love him. Why? Because he first loved us. The glue that bonded them to him was what he had given them. His time, his attention, his care, his love, his life. It was the bond that glued them together. And that's why the Apostle Paul would say in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20, that this is where he lived his life, and this is what this was the thrust of his life. In Galatians 2 and verse 20, Paul says there, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I live now in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. Then he says this, who loved me and gave himself for me. Paul is saying, I'm all in. I am living my life for him. Why? Because he loved me and he gave himself for me. That's exactly the idea in all of that. And the bond that he had with Jesus was so strong, he himself even went to his eventual death and was poured out as a drink offering. In the time that we have left this morning, I want to talk about some cases where Jesus did the very thing that I'm talking about this morning. I want to talk about some times where it really fascinates me of him being where his feet were. And the first one is in Luke chapter 8 when a woman was bleeding. If you would, turn to Luke chapter 8. In Luke chapter 8, Jairus, the ruler of the synagogue, has come to Jesus. Verse 41 says, behold, there was a man named Jairus who was the ruler of the synagogue, and he fell down at Jesus' feet, and he begged him to come to his house. For he had an only daughter who was about 12 years of age, and she was dying. And so Jesus is now on the way to Jairus' house to heal his daughter. And catch this, she's at the point of death. She could die any moment. But one of the things that happens is as he's making his way to Jairus' house, it says here, the multitudes thronged him. He's got people all around him. But there's this woman who has had this flow of blood for many years. The text will talk about how she had tried everything. It simply says in verse 43, now a woman having a flow of blood for 12 years who had spent all her livelihood on physicians and could not be healed by any, she has an idea. If I can just get to him, if I could maybe just be able to fight through the crowd and just touch the hem of his garment. Maybe, just maybe, I know he's got the power that I can be healed. And so verse 44 says, she came from behind and she touched the border of his garment. And immediately her flow of blood stopped. She's so desperate for help, she fights through just to try to touch the hem of his garment. But she wanted to do it secretly. She wanted to do it so that nobody would know. And one of the reasons is she does not want any shame to be brought on her because she's bleeding. And the law of Moses would teach that if you touch the body of anybody who's bleeding, that it will ceremonially defile them. You don't do it. And so she wants to do this secretly, but she is in desperation. So here's the crowd. They're moving along. Jesus needs to get on to where he's headed, but it's already slow go. And on top of that, she now touches him, and he stops. Verse 45, he said, who touched me? And when all denied it, Peter and those with him said, Master, the multitudes are thronging you and press you. And you say, who touched me? It's kind of like, what do you mean who touched you? Everybody's touching you. And Jesus said, no, somebody touched me. I perceived power going out from me. What I'm trying to impress upon you is that he needs to get on. But he stops. And he's now going to give attention to one woman. And he seeks her out. And verse 47 says, when the woman saw that she was not hidden, she came trembling and falling down before him. She declared to him in the presence of all the people the reason that she had touched him and how she was healed immediately. Can you see Jesus turning? Finding her, seeking her out, now talking to her, and he says, daughter, be of good cheer. Your faith has made you well. Go in peace. What I want to draw out is this. He didn't shame her. It could be that if Jesus had not stopped, that she would have forever felt like on this day that she stole something. I worked my way through the crowd. I reached out. I touched his garment. I got my miracle. And nobody knows. And I was able to take a gift from him. And you know, I can see where she might be bothered by that. That I did this secretly. And I got this blessing. And I never even said thank you. But by him stopping and giving her his attention, he singled out her faith. He said, daughter, your faith has made you well. Oh, what faith. And so now, rather than feeling shamed, her faith has been magnified, and he has used her to say to other people, this is what you do. This is what you do when you understand who I am. And this is what you do. You'll fight through every obstacle there is just to get to me. He magnifies her faith, and she is left with something wonderful on this day, all because Jesus stops and gives his attention to this one woman. Let me tell you, that's being where your feet are. And let me say this, I have to kind of give some praise here to Jairus. He seemingly lets Jesus be where his feet were. He does not say, Master, come on. You ain't got time to fool with that. Come on. Evidently, he lets him do it. Not a word is said by Jairus as he takes time with this one woman. Let me give you another one. When a friend has died, turn to Matthew 14. In Matthew 14, they beheaded John the Baptist. You remember that? And in verse 12, it says in Matthew 14, then his disciples came and they took away the body and they buried it. And they went and they told Jesus. Let me ask you a question. You ever had a close friend of you die? You had somebody very near to you die? What do you want most of the time? Most of us want to go off and be to ourselves. We don't want a party. We don't want a lot of people right now. We just want to go and absorb in what has happened here. It seems that's what Jesus wanted. Verse 13 says, when Jesus heard it, he departed from there by boat to a deserted place by himself. But when the multitudes heard it, they followed him on foot from all of the cities. So he wants to get off to a deserted place by himself, but he can't because here comes all the crowds. Here they all come. Then his disciples said to him, where can we get enough bread in the wilderness to feed such a great multitude? Because Jesus told them that I have compassion and I want to take care of these people. He was moved with compassion for them. And so it says, when it was evening, the disciples came and said, this is a deserted place and the hour is already late. Send the multitudes away that they may go into the villages and buy themselves food. But Jesus said to him, they do not need to go away. You give them something to eat. And they said to him, we have here only 5 loaves and 2 fish. He said, bring them here to me. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the grass. And he took the 5 loaves and the 2 fish. And looking up to heaven, he blessed and broke and gave the loaves to the disciples. And the disciples gave it to the multitudes. And they all ate and were filled, and they took up the 12 baskets full of fragments that remained. And those who had eaten were about 5,000 men, besides women and children. But do you see my point? He's gone off to a deserted place, but now here comes all the crowd. And the disciples even say, send them away. Get rid of them. And Jesus said, no, they'll faint on the way. He stops. He puts his own desires aside. He's present in the moment. He does what's needed for them. And who hasn't heard about the feeding of the 5,000? And he does all of that after a friend had died. That's being where you feed on. That's seeing the most pressing need right in front of you. And then I want to give you this in contrast to these others. I want to talk about some religious people who were not where their feet were. If you remember in John chapter 9, there is a man who has been blind since birth. Now let's think a moment about this. He's heard about green grass, but he's never seen it. He's heard about a blue sky, but he's never seen it. He's heard his friend's voice, but he's never seen him. Jesus comes along, takes clay, puts it on his eyes, and tells him to go wash in the pool of Siloam. And he goes and he washes, and he comes back seeing. Can you imagine what this moment is like? All of a sudden, blue! Green grass! Oh, that's beautiful! Those are mountains? And Zechariah, oh, it's so good to see you. Can you imagine the emotions that go over somebody when he's never seen and Jesus gives him his sight? Go to YouTube sometime and just type in person seeing for the first time. Type in person hearing for the first time. I did that recently and I'll just show you a couple of pictures. Here is a young woman who is married and she hears the voice of her husband for the first time. That first picture is her immediate response. Can you see the joy? Can you see the joy in her eyes and in her face? To hear her husband's voice, that other picture is her second emotion. She breaks down and cries over something that she has wanted for so long. Something she has longed for so long, she's never heard. And by modern technology, they give her the ability to hear. And she breaks down in emotion. That's what this man experiences in John chapter 9. And the religious people don't see it. The religious people aren't where their feet are. The religious people don't see what really matters on this occasion. And I want you to see what they do. Look at John chapter 9, beginning in verse 24. They called the man who was blind, and they said, give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner. And he answered and said, whether he's a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. And they said to him again, what did he do to you? How did he open your eyes? And he answered them and said, I told you already, and you don't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you also want to become his disciple? And they reviled him and said, you are his disciple, but we are Moses' disciple. We know that God spoke to Moses. As for this fellow, we do not know where he is from. And the man answered and said to them, why, this is a marvelous thing that you do not know where he is from, and yet he opened my eyes. Well, now we know that if God does not hear sinners, we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Listen to this blind man. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anybody ever opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were God, if this man were not from God, he could do nothing. And they answered and said to him, you were completely born in sin, and are you teaching us? And they cast him out. I want to ask you something. Do they get it? Do they see? Are they making any connection with this man? Do they care about this man? Do they give him good time and good attention? No. Let me tell you who the blind people were out there on that day. It's not him. They're the ones that are blind. They're the ones that don't see. And Jesus, still talking to them, In the next chapter, look at what he says. In John chapter 10, he says, beginning in verse 7, "Most assuredly I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who ever came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief does not come except to steal and kill and to destroy, but I have come that they may have life and that they may have it more abundantly." And when they cast this man out of the synagogue, guess who's going to find him? Guess who's going to go get him? Look at John 9, verse 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he had found him, he said to him, "Do you believe in the Son of God?" And he answered and said, "Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him?" And Jesus said to him, "You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking with you." And then he said, "Lord, I believe." And he worshiped him. No wonder people came to him in droves. In John 10 and verse 7, he said that, "I'm the good shepherd." And that's why they come. That's why they hear his voice. He was a glue that bonded people with him. And as we finish, I am simply saying this morning that our greatest responsibility, folks, is to become as much like him as we can. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 40, Luke chapter 6 and verse 40, it simply says, "A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone who is perfectly trained will be like his teacher." When you think about Jesus, that's him. He was always present. When he was with people, he was with people. And he wins the moment because he's in the moment. A far cry from the religious leaders of his day. I can't think of a better way for us to be like him than to be present. And as we make application to one thing, where will we be after services this morning? Will we be on our way out? Or will we desire to give people our time? Will we desire to give people our attention? Will we care about what's going on in the world of other people? When we're with people, will we be with people? There's our thoughts this morning. If you're here this morning, you need to respond to the gospel of Jesus Christ. This song simply says, "Bring Christ your broken life." If you need to respond in any way this morning to the gospel by repenting of your sins, confessing Christ as the Son of God and being baptized to have all your sins washed away, and then live faithful to him, or if you need to respond in any way, if we can pray for you and help you in any way, we want to do that. Would you come while we stand and as we sing?
Bring Christ.